writers and their love letters, next on Soundings. Hello, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with Kathy Davidson of Duke University. We'll talk about her new collection, The Book of Love. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated.
The love letter seems perfectly suited to the contradictions of a writer's life. Writers are both isolated and yet excruciatingly aware of their audience. If literature is a letter to the world, in Emily Dickinson's phrase, then the love letter may be the emblem of a vocation that demands solitude but desires communication. Like literature, a love letter is intimacy by proxy.
Kathy Davidson of Duke University, reading from her new collection, The Book of Love, available from Pocket Books. The Book of Love is subtitled Writers and Their Love Letters. In preparing her anthology, Kathy Davidson went through more than 3,000 love letters dating from ancient Mediterranean culture to the present day. She organized the collection as if it were one large love affair revolving around the universality of the love letter. I asked Kathy Davidson to describe the literary and emotional characteristics she looked for when she assembled the Book of Love.
Well, the first characteristic was readability. I looked for letters that moved me, that were funny, interesting, sad, different, eccentric, that showed something of the writer's style. I guess I was mostly interested in the relationship between the love letter and the literature that the writer produced. Uh-huh. And so I was looking for those kinds of quirks that said, this is Hemingway, or this is Edith Wharton, or this is Walt Whitman, and tried to see the way in which they were transformed in the letter. And then often taken out of the letter and put into the literature itself.
How do you locate the love letter, Kathy Davidson, in space and time? Do we associate particular characteristics with love letters that were written, in antiquity by Sappho, in contrast to maybe a love letter that was written just a few years ago?
Well, one of the things I found interesting was that although I would have thought the love letters were historically determined in some ways, the expression actually turned out to be pretty much the same. I mean, I could read Sappho's expressions of love, and they didn't sound to me very different than John Cheever's expressions of love to his lover.
Are you telling me that human nature doesn't change that much over all these years?
I guess I'm not supposed to believe that, am I? But in fact, I think when people are in love and feel passionate, that they fall into certain kinds of patterns that are almost, and this is one of the theories I have in this book, that are almost literary patterns. There's certain things people do when they're in love, and there's certain ways that people express that love.
For all of the deep ways that we feel, pain and passion and exhilaration and depression, is the love letter really that original as a form of literature?
It's interesting. The most original writers will sometimes fall into the most abominable cliches. It's almost unavoidable that you start sounding like a Hallmark card in a love letter. I think it's almost required. You feel, I'm in love, therefore I must sound in a certain way.
Uh-huh. And what would you say, Kathy, is the most original of all of the expressions that you found here?
Probably the most original letter writer is Conrad Aiken. He was not a great poet, particularly.
And not a household name.
And certainly not a household name, but boy, could he write letters. And unfortunately, what this required in his life was that he kept having to fall in love with women in order that he could generate all of this gorgeous prose. And he wrote hilarious, cantankerous, crazy, wonderful letters. In one of his letters, he describes how marvelous it is to be staying in this cheap hotel where he can get a blanket out of the drawer because then he can call Joan and tell her about it. And so something as mundane as taking the blanket out of the drawer becomes erotic.
So some of these writers actually go to the trouble of falling in love so that they can write letters.
That, I think, is the most cynical thing that I discovered in writing the book, that in fact I felt some writers, and Conrad Aiken is certainly at the top of the list, made themselves fall in love because they felt they wrote better when they were in love, and often, in fact, pilfered their passions and their emotional lives for material for their books.
Yeah, I believe it's Somerset Maugham that has a character, a novel about a character who observes love affairs in his wife so that he can be inspired to write great novels.
Yes, and I mean, I think there's a lot of historical basis for that novel, exactly.
Uh-huh. Hemingway is a character that comes to mind. I mean, here is a guy, we got contradictions in the sense that he was a tough guy, and yet he could be very tender in his letters. He went through a string of women. Was this deliberate?
Well, it's interesting. Hemingway's even more paradoxical because he tended not to write letters while he was in love, but wrote plots based on the love he was feeling for the women. In fact, he said that when he was madly in love, he found it hard, really difficult to write passionately, except in his fiction. So there's this kind of displacement of the passion onto the literary work, and so the actual woman that he's in love with never really gets it except secondhand in a novel in which she's transformed into a fictional character. But definitely his writer's life corresponded to his love life.
Pick me an example, Kathy, from this category, falling in love.
Well, one of the most interesting is Zelda Sayer, who's writing to F. Scott Fitzgerald. And one of the reasons it's interesting is this letter is an incredibly passionate letter, but it's obvious that there's something very demented, very sad and desperate about this love, too. Let me read it.
Sure, what does she say?
I look down the tracks and see you coming, and out of every haze and mist, your darling rumpled trousers are hurrying to me. Without you, dearest, dearest, I couldn't see or hear or feel or think or live. I love you so, and I'm never in all our lives going to let us be apart another night. It's like begging for mercy of a storm or killing beauty or growing old without you. I want to kiss you so, and in the back where your dear hair starts and your chest, I love you, I can't tell you how much, to think that I'll die without you knowing. Gufo, you've got to try to feel how much I do, how inanimate I am when you're gone. I can't even hate these damnable people. Nobody's got any right to live but us, and they're dirtying up our world, and I can't hate them because I want you so. Come quick to me. I could never do without you if you hated me and were covered with sores like a leper. If you ran away with another woman and starved me and beat me, I still would want you, I know.
Well, I don't know what you mean by demented, Kathy, but one of the things that comes through in that excerpt is the intensely personal nature of the love letter. I mean, you've got to read, you've got to have a mini historian here to figure out all these references and what it is that went into the composition of the letter.
Yes, it is intensely personal. It's also intensely masochistic, and I think that's what's so sad. Because
Leper sores.
I would love you if you beat me, if you starved me. There's almost an invitation to violence there. Hurt me. I mean, loving me is hurting me. And of course, their love affair was exactly that. It was an incredibly complex mixture of masochism and sadism in which each one took the other's letters quite literally and put them into their own works of fiction. In fact, one of the big arguments that Zelda and F. Scott had so often was over who was the real writer. And in fact, Scott more than Zelda plagiarized from Zelda's love letters and put them in his books.
Is it fair to say that love letters become therefore a form of therapy, that we work our problems through by writing to other people about our own most intense and personal feelings?
I think it is. In fact, one of the points I make in the book is that a love letter is really a love letter to yourself. Mm. That falling in love, as often said, is a form of self-love. But the letters, too, are often self-presentation about how do I present my best self?
Yeah,
how
they're performances.
They're performances. They're absolutely performances. And that's one of those generic requirements, I think, for a love letter, is a love letter has to be a performance. It's rarely just telling. It's showing. It's tap dancing. It's an extravaganza, and often an emotional extravaganza, too.
Sure, you wouldn't write it unless you thought that somebody was going to see it. And what, in the back of the mind, the writer is thinking, there are many somebodies who might see this.
Well, this is another thing, sometimes not even in the back of the mind. Ford Maddox Ford told Hemingway, always keep carbon copies of your love letters. And what he meant was write for posterity. You know, you have an audience out there, not just the woman who's going to be receiving the letters, but this whole literary world. And it made Hemingway so mad that he went back to his apartment and burned every letter in the place. And as he said, especially Ford Madox Ford's letters.
What do you mean by love's infinite variety? You've got some subsections there in your book on the Book of Love.
I decided early on that there are many different kinds of love, and not just necessarily erotic love, that there's a kind of love that happens with friendship that's every bit as passionate, and in fact, in its literary form, in the love letter, there's the same kind of self-exposure and self-exploration in a letter between friends that there often is in letters between physical lovers. Often letters between parents and children are heartbreakingly intense and personal, and often involve the same kinds of self-revelation. Let me give you an example. Anne Sexton, who led an extremely tormented life and who knew for many years that she was going to kill herself, wrote a letter to her daughter a few weeks before she finally did, before Anne Sexton finally did kill herself. And it's a letter that she intended for her daughter to read when her daughter was 40 years old. Anne Sexton herself was 40 when she wrote the letter, and her own mother was dead, and she knew that at some point her daughter would miss her, and this was a letter to be read after her death. And it's quite an amazing letter. Dear Linda, I'm in the middle of a flight to St. Louis to give a reading. I was reading a New Yorker story that made me think of my mother, and all alone in the seat, I whispered to her, "I know, Mother, I know." And I thought of you, someday flying somewhere all alone, and me dead perhaps, and you wishing to speak to me. And I went to speak back. Linda, maybe it won't be flying. Maybe it will be at your own kitchen table drinking tea some afternoon when you are 40. Anytime, I want to say back, first, I love you. Second, you never let me down. Third, I know I was there once. I too was 40 and with a dead mother who I still needed. This is my message to the 40-year-old Linda. No matter what happens, you were always my bobolink, my special Linda Gray. Life is not easy. It is awfully lonely. I know that. Now you too know it, wherever you are, Linda, talking to me. But I've had a good life. I wrote unhappy, but I lived to the hilt. You too, Linda, live to the hilt, to the top. I love you, 40-year-old Linda, and I love what you do, what you find, what you are. Be your own woman. Belong to those you love. Talk to my poems and talk to your heart. I'm in both if you need me. I lied, Linda. I did love my mother and she loved me. She never held me, but I miss her so that I have to deny I ever loved her or she me. Silly Anne. So there.
How sad and how touching and tender all at the same time. It speaks to the question of, if only I had said such and such to the person who is now no longer able to hear my words.
Exactly. And I think part of what a love letter does is gives you the chance to say such and such. It finally gives you the chance to express all of those things that in normal conversation, even in the normal world, the out of passion world, we're not allowed to say. You're allowed to be foolish in love letters. You're allowed to be extravagant in love letters. Things writers wouldn't do in their real writing. Sentiment. Again.
Clichés.
Clichés. They're everywhere in love letters. Love letters give you permission. Give you permission to excess.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week is Kathy Davidson, a professor of English at Duke University. We're talking about her new anthology, The Book of Love, subtitled Writers and Their Love Letters. One of the sections here in your book, Kathy Davidson, on The Book of Love, Writers and Their Love Letters, is called Absence. Now, I suppose love, like drama, has to have conflict. Tell me about that.
Yes, absence is important. And in fact, some lovers arranged absences in order that they could write letters. The most comical one in some ways is Anais Nin and Henry Miller. Anais Nin's biographer says that she couldn't wait for Henry Miller to leave because that gave her a chance to write him a love letter. And in fact, sometimes they would be together all afternoon making passionate love. And then she'd say, "You have to leave me now." He would leave. She would close the door and she'd immediately write him a letter so they could talk about it the next day and discuss it. It was a very literary relationship that they had.
Now, that was a peculiar relationship, not only from the standpoint, it was peculiar because there were three people involved.
Yes.
in that love affair. Yeah. How do you figure out the lines that connect what we call gender and sexuality? Well, we talk about heterosexuality and homoerotic love. Mm-hmm. One category better than the other, as it were, in producing love letters?
Not at all. I mean, in fact, I don't even make the distinction between heterosexuality and homosexuality in the book in the sense that people love. I mean, people don't say, "I'm writing a homosexual love letter" or a heterosexual love letter. They write love letters.
Right.
Now, the difference is that how people interpret that love in the rest of their lives can be vastly different. Probably the most tragic instance of that is John Cheever, who had homosexual feelings and hated his homosexuality. Mm. And one of the consequences of that is that he was often a terrible person to live around, mean to his wife, mean to his children, most of all mean to himself, partly because of this terrible self-hatred that mm-hmm. came from his own sexual feelings for men.
Well, now, by contrast, one of our classic American writers, I don't know if you call Cheever, if you put him into that category, but I was thinking of Walt Whitman. You mentioned an example of a love letter to Whitman from one of his young lovers. Tell me about that.
It's in fact one of the most beautiful letters in the book. Walt Whitman met a young man named Fred Vaughan, who was quite literally illiterate, and he taught Fred Vaughan to read, he taught Fred Vaughan to write, he taught Fred Vaughan to appreciate Emerson and the great writers of the time. But it wasn't just teacher-student relationship. He also learned from Fred Vaughan something about the sound of working-class language, and he incorporated the lyricism of Fred Vaughan's language into his own poetry. Late in Whitman's life, after he'd suffered a terribly debilitating stroke, he received a beautiful letter from Fred Vaughan that's a retrospective letter about what the relationship had meant to him. Here's a section of Fred Vaughan's letter to Walt Whitman. "There is never a day passes but what I think of you. So much have you left to be remembered by a Broadway stage, a Fulton ferry boat, a bale of cotton on the dock, the Brooklyn Daily Times, a ship loading or unloading at the wharf, a poor man fallen from the roof of a new building, a woman and child suffocated by smoke in a burning tenement house. All, to me, speak of thee, dear Walt." What's so beautiful about that is it reads like a Whitman poem.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, there's the source itself. I don't know if you find those lines in Whitman's poetry, but there's the rough stuff that he put it together
with. Exactly, the cataloging. The making of beauty from tragic or mundane events listed in a catalog of abundant life. You know, all the things we think of as Walt Whitman.
Exactly. What about this category, love hurts?
Ooh.
We all know that, but
yes.
how did you pick these painful examples?
That was the hardest part of doing the book, is so much of love hurts. And writers are eloquent and passionate in their love letters. They're even more eloquent in their painful letters, their letters of rejection. There's so many expressions of just gaping wounds, gaping emotional wounds. And
give me an example, Kathy.
One of the most tragic stories is the story of Edith Wharton's love. She fell in love with W. Morton Fullerton, a man who manifestly did not deserve such a woman in his life. And he wouldn't tell her the love affair was over. So for months and even into years, she kept saying, "Give me a sign. Let's end this. This is just too painful."
No closure.
And no closure whatsoever. He just sort of dragged it all out and allowed it to be as painful and indefinite and unclosed as it possibly could be. And one of the saddest things that Wharton ever wrote is a very prosaic line in one of her letters to him where she says, "I enclose your letters in another envelope. No, after all, I find they will fit in this."
How telling.
And that's exactly what happened. She would write these voluminous letters in which she poured out all of her emotions to Fullerton. and he would write back these cryptic little messages.
Well, you, as a matter of fact, you say in the Book of Love, Kathy Davidson, that Edith Wharton is, the English professor in you comes through, the paradigm of the love letter. What about that?
Yes, she is the paradigm of a love letter because she invented Morton Fullerton before she met him. She wrote about women who were in love with inadequate men who did them wrong. And then she fell in love with Fullerton, who, in essence, was a character from a Wharton novel. And then after he did her wrong, she wrote about him again. And in fact, I think her masterpiece, The Age of Innocence, is an attempt to gain some kind of dignity from the lack of dignity that she experienced in that long, long, drawn-out ending of the relationship with Fullerton.
Mm. What about the section called After Great Pain? I mean, here we're going to see some light. We're going to have a, if not end on a happy note, at least we're not going to end on the absence of love.
Well, in fact, the book was so depressing. There were so many writers who had experienced such painful love relationships in their lives that I was determined I was not going to end the book with a Dear John.
Well, Americans love a happy ending,
right?
Don't they?
Well, in fact, the book has two happy endings. The one is the sort of philosophical happy ending where people reflect back after great pain, to quote Emily Dickinson, reflect back on their love and try to come up with something that they can salvage from it.
Right.
The most common one. I gained self-knowledge from this. I learned to love myself
again.
I'm
a better person.
I am a better person for this. Mm. We will be friends forever, right?
Oh,
we all know that. And the second one is actually falling in love again. That's the happiest part, is that even people who go through terribly traumatic relationships somehow are willing to risk it again.
Is love essentially, therefore, as you have put this collection together, Kathy, is it essentially a religious experience, a redemptive kind
yes,
of thing?
Yes, in fact, many, many writers talk about love in spiritual and religious terms. One of the most common images in writers' letters is Lazarus back from the dead. And Conrad Aiken, I am Lazarus back from the dead with the
right.
cobwebs on him. I mean, it's a sense that you were dead, you were emotionally dead, and often you were dead in literary terms. Writers fall in love when they have writer's block, and suddenly passionately in love, everything is wonderful again. The writer starts writing again. The pulse quickens, and it feels like you're given a reprieve, like you've been allowed to come back from the dead.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think that the bigger purpose of this book was to show people that they're not alone, even when at that terrible time after a relationship has ended, when you feel more alone than alone can ever be.
Right.
And to make people realize that there are patterns, that other people have experienced the same kinds of pains, and maybe with that kind of understanding to come to better terms with the unsuccess of a relationship. I think in some ways this is a book for lovers, because there are some passionate, erotic, wonderful letters. Vita Sackville-West writing to Virginia Woolf, I'm reduced to a thing that wants Virginia. I mean, you know, this is a great passionate moment. But I think it's also a good book for people who have experienced the worst parts of love, in the sense that these letters give you some hope that it's possible to love again, even when you've had terrible emotional devastation.
Are you going to be accused, Kathy, of elevating a love letter to elevating the love letter to a sort of what status in the literary pantheon that it really doesn't deserve?
Oh, I hope so. I think these love letters are often great literature.
They are literature.
They are performances. They are literature. And that, again, was one of the things I used when I selected the book, because I was looking for letters that were forms of literature. You cannot tell an Emily Dickinson love letter from an Emily Dickinson poem.
Right.
I mean, they scan the same way. The passion is the same. They look the same on the page. I mean, it's the same. It's seamless.
You also say that every reader of a love letter is a voyeur.
Yes. I think this speaks to me of me as much as anyone. I mean, you are really prying into somebody. You're reading someone else's mail. You're prying into their most personal life.
Right.
On the other hand, as we mentioned earlier, some writers are actually writing to posterity. So then you have the sense that if you're a voyeur, the writer is also participating in this little act and is performing his or her own kind of exhibitionism. So you don't have to feel terribly guilty about the voyeurism.
Kathy Davidson, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Before our taping, you mentioned a letter, a love letter, that you wanted to get onto the radio program. It involves, what, a rather unlikely figure here, William Faulkner.
Yes, it's actually not a love letter because Faulkner, in fact, wouldn't allow any of his love letters to be reproduced or reprinted. But in his fiction, he has a sentence which I think speaks in some ways to the whole book, and that's, he says, between grief and nothing, I would choose grief. And I think that's sort of what all of these writers in this book are saying. When you fall in love, you have no idea if it's going to work or it isn't going to work. It's a gamble. It's a terrible gamble.
Well, we're back to religion. It's an act of faith.
It's an act of faith. It's absolutely an act of faith. Uh-huh. And yet it's a sense in your life that if that's the choice between risking grief or risking nothingness, I would choose grief.
Kathy Davidson, I want to thank you for this wonderful conversation on your new book here. This collection is called The Book of Love, Writers and Their Love Letters. You are a professor of English at Duke University. The Book of Love is available. It's out in hardback now from Pocket Books. Thanks for coming by the National Humanities Center. I admire this collection, and I wish you well in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, I do. Well, it says so in this book of love. Ours is the one that's true. Wonder, wonder, wonder who wrote the book of love. I wonder who, yeah, who wrote the book of love.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. You've been listening to a conversation with Kathy Davidson, a professor of English at Duke University. Kathy Davidson is the editor of The Book of Love, subtitled Writers and Their Love Letters, recently published by Pocket Books. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. The program number this week is 639. That's program number 639, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The center welcomes your comments. Next week, join me for conversations with the writers Jill McCorkle and Amy Hempel. Jill McCorkle will discuss her latest book, Crash Diet. Amy Hempel will talk about her new collection of stories, At the Gates of the Animal Kingdom. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. The Book of Love, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation with Kathy Davidson of Duke University. We'll talk about her new anthology, The Book of Love, subtitled Writers and Their Love Letters. From the Ancient World to the Modern, a sampling of love letters from the world's great writers. The Book of Love, readings and discussion, this week on Soundings.